From beach towels to tea towels and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. You're with Bruce DeTorres and World Stage on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
World Stage indeed, exposing the tyrannies and exploring our power with deep dives into history, current events, dangerous trends, and the nature of reality. Before I introduce my guest, I want to tell you about a recent Substack written by Anton Chaitkin. So follow this, Anton Chaitkin. His last name is Chaitkin. AntonChaitkin.substack. Title, James Bullock, Teddy Roosevelt's uncle and mentor, funded the Lincoln assassination. And this, I don't have a date, but he published this, I think, just in the last week or so. Based on the depiction from a mechanical slide, this is a genuine scoop. Mr. Chaitkin is in the middle of writing and finishing volume two of a three-volume series of Who We Are, about American history from Franklin to Kennedy, I believe. And this is a genuine scoop. At the time of its original publication, the article included documents never appeared publicly before. It sets forth rather urgently relevant background to two presidential assassinations. So you got the gist of it there. And AntonChaitkin.substack, Chaitkin.com. Many, many seminal books of incredible insight into what made America great in the areas, in the time periods it was allowed to implement, basically the economics of Alexander Hamilton. Anton Chaitkin. With me this hour is David Knight, who's been researching the John F. Kennedy assassination since 1989. And he has been part of Project JFK, CSI Dallas, at projectjfk.com, since 1991, along with Casey Quinlan and Brian Edwards, with whom he also co-authored Blueprint for Murder, Volume 1. David hosts The Journey and the Spotlight Series programs on Zoom with replays on the YouTube channel Project JFK. And David has made many documentaries, and he's given many presentations about the Kennedy assassination, JFK's assassination. In 2018, he presented groundbreaking research involving the Tom Dillard photo, possibly exposing a shooter, which would be a huge stride toward the truth about what happened in 1963. David is my friend. Project JFK invited me to give a talk or two a couple of years ago on JFK, and I am very grateful, David, for you joining me today. How are you?
Thank you very much, Bruce, for having me. The tables have sort of turned on me because usually I have the guests on my show and I'm on yours this time. So just getting geared up for the national conference next week in Dallas and trying to get everything put together.
Well, let's talk about the conference. Folks can find all the information at jfkhistorical.com, right?
Yes, they can find the information there, and also we have the information posted on projectjfk.com. Mm-hmm. It will be in Dallas, Texas, held at the DoubleTree Hotel. That will be next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. There is some stuff still going on Sunday as well with Judith Baker. I will actually be heading home that Sunday morning after we give the walking tour in Dealey Plaza. So we still have tickets available for in-person and also on Zoom.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's basically November 16th to the 19th. JFKhistorical.com for tickets information. If folks can't get there, there's a way to acquire just Zoom access and ability to be able to enjoy it. Tell me what you are doing for the conference, and also what does it feature in terms of the number and the quality of the speakers? And talk about the conference, please.
Okay, well, I'm actually going to be speaking on Saturday. I have two presentations to give, one for my hour presentation, and then I'm also going to be doing the banquet. I'm one of the banquet speakers. The people that we're going to have in in person here. Let me pull up the website real quick.
And Project JFK is a sponsor, right? You're hosting it.
Yeah, we're actually working in connection with David Denton and the JFK Historical Group, along with Judith Baker's group is involved as well. Mm-hmm. We have our speakers lined up. We've got Gary Fannin, Chris Milligan, Robert Groden, Dick Russell, Randy Benson, Chris
Let's talk
Gallup.
About those guys. Hey, before you go further, Let's talk about them. You know, Chris Milligan is my publisher and boss at Trine Day. Dick Russell wrote The Man Who Knew Too Much About Richard K. Snagel, the intelligence fellow in 1963 who went into a bank, shot some bullets in the, or a post office, shot some bullets in the ceiling, went outside and waited to be arrested because he's the man who knew too much. He wanted to be safe in jail and not have anything to do with what he knew about the assassination. Just an example. Talk about some of the other, just those names you just mentioned, who, you know, the other few that we've mentioned there, and we'll go through all of them and say some tidbits about all that we can maybe.
Okay, absolutely. Well, Gary Fannin has a, he's got a few books that are coming out that are going to be, available at the conference. Been working with Gary the last couple years. Heck of a great guy. Robert Groden, of course, first generation researcher. I think everybody, knows Robert. His, last book that he did, Absolute Proof, was just, it was groundbreaking. Really tied in the first two books, The Killing of a President and the Lee Harvey Oswald book. Dick Russell, as a matter of fact,
Second, go back to Robert Groden and tell everyone what he did in on television in 1975.
On the Good Night America, which was hosted by Geraldo Rivera, he was the first person to show the Zapruder film, which at that time nobody had seen in the public, and he was able to show that for the first time on TV. And I think at that point, people started to pay attention to the fact that, not all the shots could have came from the rear in the in the Texas School of Depository building by Oswald.
Did you see that live when it happened, when he showed it on TV, David?
Well, no, I didn't. I wasn't involved in doing any type of research. I was born in 74. I'm trying to think the year that he put that out.
No, he did that. I saw it live. It was March 6, 1975.
Yes. Okay. I was still crawling around in diapers.
Yes, you were. Well, I was in eighth grade, and there was a build-up to it. It was advertised, you know, a week or so in advance, I guess, in TV Guide, which was the little magazine every house bought in order to know what's on my three channels, you know, this upcoming week. And I watched it, and it was horrific. I remember feeling like punched in the gut, you know, to see for the first time. It wasn't even a great version of the film, but it was clear enough that Kennedy had, you know, his head basically explodes in the film, and he gets violently banged back into the left. I'm since convinced that the film's been altered. So we don't know what to trust. I don't know what to trust about the artwork of that explosion. My reading says that frames were removed and that the debris field was actually much worse, according to the old timers who've been interviewed, who saw the original or handled the original in the first couple of days. So, tell me whatever else you want about Robert Groden, and then we'll keep going through some of the speakers, please.
Well, Robert will be in attendance, and Robert's also a main staple down there in Dealey Plaza at his table right there on the right next to the North Knoll.
Yeah.
So if you get a chance to to either come to the conference, or at least if you're in Dallas and you have an opportunity to stop by and visit with him. He's a plethora of information that people need to tap into.
Indeed he is. And maybe that's enough of the you know, people can go to the site and see the speakers for the next few days. It's enough to say that some of the most hardworking, well-respected, well-received, well-acclaimed researchers in the field for the last 60 years are going to be in attendance. And not least, including yourself, my good friend. David, talk to me, please, about your journey into discovering, getting fascinated by, and researching the beginning of it. Like, what was that like for you to get into the assassination, and how did that happen?
Well, growing up as a kid, in mom and dad's house, I mean, there was always a picture of JFK, and there was a statue of him. I believe it was a bank that sat on mom's knickknack shelf. Really didn't know much about JFK other than the fact that he was a president of the United States that got killed in office. It wasn't until 1989 when Casey Quinlan came over to my junior high school. He gave a presentation to the ninth grade class. He walked over. The very first thing he did was he walked on stage, took our history book that we were being taught out of, and threw it in the trash can. At that very moment, he had everyone's attention. There wasn't a single person sleeping. We were all glued to what Casey had to have, you know, what he had to say. Once that hour and a half presentation was given, this was back before PowerPoint. It was on the old slide projectors. We got out of school, and my mom picked me up, and I said, we have to go to the library immediately. There was a new spark of interest of something for me to, armchair quarterback. And, especially with the JFK case, I feel it's the pinnacle case of something that it's the whodunit. And between myself and my mother, we checked out all the, VHS tapes, books, and articles that I could, took them home, and then, later on for my birthday and Christmas, that's the only thing that was on my list of things I needed. I needed research materials. I needed videos back then. And it became not only a hobby, but a passion.
And what was it? What was it about it that just never, you know, never ceased to be interesting to you?
I think it was the fact of actually seeing the Zapruder film for the first time. Going back and, you know, Casey read the two paragraphs, because that's all that was covered on JFK and his assassination or history book. And after reading those two paragraphs and an hour and a half of him discussing how the Warren Commission could not be, you know, correct in the finding that Oswald did it alone, I felt like I got lied to. And I was always brought up to respect my teachers, you know, listen to authority, and not ask questions. After 90 minutes of being with Casey Quinlan, my viewpoints had changed. And that's when I started asking questions and demanding answers. But I had to do my research so I knew what to ask and what to look at as the overall picture.
What were the milestones in your stepping into even deeper research along the lines of field trips maybe to Dallas, I think you took. And then when did you first start teaching, sharing, et cetera?
My very first going and returning to the scene of the crime was in November of 91. We stepped off the bus that morning, and I thought it was going to be bigger because it looked bigger on TV, but it was actually a smaller area than what I was expecting. But being able to, you know, as a high school student, being able to go to the scene of the crime and learn it firsthand, I couldn't get that out of a history book. Unless it was somebody that was passionate and had done the research as a teacher, I was not going to get anything out of it. So that was my first, you know, trip to Dallas. And then, that was in 91. Casey, of course, had Project JFK going as the director. Back in the day, it was with Mark Taylor. Brian Edwards came on before I did. I came on shortly after. And then it was just, I mean, we had a good team going. We started taking groups of high school, college, some junior high school students, on long bus rides down to Dallas. But getting a chance to meet Madeline Brown and Dallas Police Department retired officer, his name's going to escape me. First name is
Tom.
The fellow
who was next to Oswald in the basement?
No, actually, he was off duty that day driving through Dealey Plaza, and he had his daughter with him. It was it was coming from, you know, I don't think he had anything to do with the assassination. I don't think he was one of the DPD that had that. But getting a chance to hear from, you know, ex-DPD officer at the time, he had a great story, and it,
what was
the
his
whole
story
9-hour ride home.
What was his story in a nutshell?
His story in a nutshell was, obviously it could have been some of, go back and listen to the recording.
David,
you know, he feels
David. Sorry, yeah. Let me reintroduce you. David Knight is with me. He's been researching the JFK assassination since 1989, and he's one of the three amigos, as I call him, over at ProjectJFK.com. And now here is important information from TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Rick Munn.
I'm looking also at South Africa in terms of Eskom, which is a company that we have talked about a lot here. That's the South African electricity provider. Eskom has posted a massive 24 billion rand loss for 2022-2023 financial year, exacerbated by a huge escalation in load shedding, which is basically blackouts, for want of a better expression, mounting municipal debt and skyrocketing losses due to criminal activity. That's both within the company, I would say, and outside of the company. The group presented its first full year financials for the 12 months ending 31st of March on Tuesday. It said the year was characterized by a significant deterioration of performance, including a steep decline in energy availability of 56%, down from 62%. So half the country are having difficulty getting any electricity at all, and most places are undergoing what's called load shedding, which means for up to 10 hours per day, you could be disconnected from the electricity supply in South Africa.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
The Lights is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. They've launched a new service called Wake Up Your Neighbours, where you can get copies delivered to the streets right around you if you don't want to do it yourself. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. Thelightpaper.co.uk.
Caution. You are about to hear
today's news talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country's all about.
TNT Radio.
This is Bruce Lutaris. This is World Stage. With me is David Knight. And we are talking about the John F. Kennedy assassination. Now, this month on the 22nd, as you well know, David, is the 60th anniversary of the assassination. And there's two ways I would like you to describe all you can about all you know about the assassination. Pick one of these two angles first. The case, as a crime on the street, as a police crime, contrasting what you and researchers have found for 60 years, you since 1989, about what really happened versus the official story. I want you to thoroughly explore that, maybe first, and then we'll save time before the end. I'll ask you, what shape is the country in as a result from that, and what do we need to do? You good?
Yeah, I'm good. Real quick before I get into that, Tom Tilson was the name. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you.
The DPD officer. I feel that, you know, looking back at the JFK assassination, it is truly the crime of the century. The day that JFK was killed on the streets of downtown Dallas was a day that not only here in the United States, but as a world, we lost our innocence. It's something that has haunted us because we don't have the true answer of what and why. We have theories, but we don't have the true what and why of and how. We know how he was killed, but we don't have all the answers, and that's why we keep searching for for the truth. I think that as we look back at how the case was handled, how Oswald, I feel he was set up as a patsy to take the fall. They had to have their scapegoat. But unfortunately, with what the Warren Commission came out with later on, knowing the fact that are we going to go back and read those 26 volumes and the 800-page plus report? There's a lot of people that have never taken the time to experience that boredom, I want to say. But you have to go back and look at that, because what was handled, it was shoddy police work. It was a rush to judgment, not to quote Mark Lane, but it was a rush to judgment. And to get the story out there so that way officially Texas and the government had their man. And looking back at now, going through the documents 60 years later that are being released, we realize that in those documents, what we've been researching for over six decades, we didn't have the answers then, and we don't have the answers now. We have theories, we have bits and pieces as a puzzle to put together. Go ahead, Bruce.
Well, no, I think you're probably unpacking exactly what I would ask next, so I'm going to listen.
Okay. I think that, did we have the true police investigation that started at Dealey Plaza in the TSBD? And in that investigation, who was in charge of that investigation? Because we look at Dallas Police Department, we look at Secret Service, we look at, other agencies. Could they have been FBI, CIA in the area? And if so, were they real people or were they actors doing a job that they were part of the assassination? So, unfortunately, it was probably one of the worst handled crime scene investigations that the world's ever seen.
Well, tell me, briefly, describe what's the official story, and then tell me what has been pretty well established that demolishes the official story.
Well, when we look at the official story, the Warren Commission says three shots. Oswald did it. He did it alone. And unfortunately, he was the alleged assassin. He was killed by Jack Ruby, or was it Jack Ruby? That's another area that we could get into, but I don't think we have time today to do so. If you fast forward from 1964 when that report came out and you look at 1979 for the HSCA, they were investigating not only JFK, but MLK Jr. They come up with another official finding that Oswald probably acted, as a conspiracy more than just him by himself. Or are we supposed to believe that Oswald had anything to do with it? When you look at the Zapruder film, when you look at the photographic and the video evidence, you listen to the eyewitnesses, you read their testimony, or the testimony that was given to the Warren Commission, was that correct? Going back and talking to eyewitnesses now, we have several eyewitnesses that give deathbed confessions. They come forward, they talk at conferences, they talk. There's some eyewitnesses that will go to Dealey Plaza and tell their story, what they remembered. Some stories change over time, and some stories we think they've changed because they weren't what was in the official record by the Warren Commission. So this case is ever involved, it's ever evolving. That's kind of where we're at with looking back at the evidence to piece it all together.
Go ahead.
I'm going to say, if we look at what is, what the official finding was to the next official finding to what is now coming out in the documents, which we've all kind of had serious researchers have had an idea. This is what has taken place, but can we prove it? That's the biggest thing that we have. We know something happened and it wasn't a lone nut assassin. it had to be a conspiracy.
Do me a favor. Think about what Jim Mars brought forth in Crossfire, what James Douglas brought forth in JFK and the Unspeakable, and what David Talbot brought forth in The Devil's Chessboard about Alan Dulles. And tell me what logistically, who was involved and who did what?
I would say we're looking at two, and not everybody involved in these two groups, but I'm looking at the CIA and the military industrial complex. When we look at Alan Dulles, Kennedy had made enemies with Alan Dulles with his firing and wanting to, quote unquote, you know, splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind. We've heard that quote in the movie JFK. Am I saying that every single person that worked for the CIA or in the military had something to do with this? No, just like not everybody that worked for the Dallas Police Department had something to do with this. But you have bad actors in each group that needed to get this done, whether it happened on the streets of downtown Dallas or whether it happened perhaps down in Florida or Chicago. Either way, they had the plan to take Kennedy out, and they succeeded in that. And they did it in front of basically everybody that was standing there in Dealey Plaza in broad daylight.
What's your sense of how many shots were fired and where they came from?
I would say I would be looking at 6 to 8 shots. I would say we would have a triangular crossfire, just like what Jim Mars had stated. If Oswald was up in the window, he had a perfect opportunity with the limousine coming right forward up Houston before it made its way to Elm. I think the reason why the shooting teams, and there had to be more than just one team, there were multiple teams, probably between at least 2 to 3 teams. We have shots coming from behind Dow Tech's building. We have shots coming from the North Knoll. Sherry Feaster brought up shots coming from the South Knoll, and I put a shooter that started all the shots right on the bridge. And it leads me to what I've talked about before, what you had spoke about earlier, and what I will be talking about more in depth next week in Dallas, which is the Tom Dillard photo that was in the public domain for so long. But unfortunately, there was two versions of that photograph, the cropped and the uncropped version. And we're only talking about a cropping of that photograph of about an inch. But in that inch, you take away James Tague and you take away a possible shooter on the bridge. That shot lines up perfectly with going for the throat shot. I spoke about this last week on the journey, and that's what kind of, you know, has been pushing a little bit more towards my speech next week. But I've had a lot of people that, you know, they look at it going, okay, it matches, but there's a few problems. Or I have some that state, mm-hmm. no, that matches perfectly. But why would somebody mm-hmm. be shooting through a windshield to hit Kennedy in the throat? And then we go back and look at the autopsy photographs, and we look at what happened with the Parkland doctors compared to Bethesda. There's a reason why we see a perfect round hole in Parkland, a gaping mm-hmm. gash at Bethesda. And we had to realize that the shot that could have came from Oswald or a shooter in the TSPD, I can't see it going in the back, going up, out the throat, and then into Conley. So right. If we look at the research, and I spent 6 years on this presentation, and that's going out and talking to manufacturers, snipers, police departments, military, ex-military, the front shooter lines up, and we have the photograph that shows there was mm-hmm. something there, and within just the next cancellary photograph that comes out right after, mm-hmm. that person is no longer there. So
from the position of that potential shooter, could he have hit Kennedy in the throat and shot over the top of the windshield?
with the windshield coming, with the vehicle coming towards the bridge, the over or underpass, whichever way you want to describe it, I believe that the shooter was actually aiming over the windshield, but unfortunately, I don't think he adjusted for the bullet drop, and that's why the bullet went through the windshield. Either way, the shot made its mark. Was he shooting at Kennedy's throat, at his face, or at his head? And could a possible front shot come from that that could have taken out, you know, the headshot? That's possible too. So you could actually not only bring in the throat shot, but also a headshot from that same location.
Yeah. You know, here's some speculation that's just occurring to me. It's assuming that there was a foul up in not capturing Oswald at the Texas School Book Depository, and assuming that there may have been a plan at the Dallas Hospital Parkland. I'm gonna pause that speculation. I was about to say, you know, did they shoot him in the throat to give him a few seconds to know we're taking you down, you know? Because if they were always going to control the autopsy, and they always were, then yeah, they could shoot him from the front without a second thought, and probably the frontal shooter there didn't want to hit him in the throat. Definitely, you know, it makes sense, just logical that he'd want to go over the windshield and get him in the head, but something went wrong. You know, with the first shot, it often does, you know, you have to cue up, you know, that gets you established, like, okay, where's the target? And now where's the bullseye?
I think the throat shot was an immobilizing shot, which I have some speculation. And of course, all it is speculation, but I think it was a shot to immobilize JFK to keep him upright. If that's what they were going for. And if we remember going back and watching JFK's speeches, he had his wit, he had his charm, but he had the voice, and he had the voice of America. He had the voice of the world. So what better way of taking away that voice by a gunshot?
Well,
so even if he would have survived, even if he would have survived, he would never been able to, you know, be the president that he once was.
Yeah. It's enjoyable, that kind of speculation. I want to ask you more about either the shooting or what do you remember or know about the performance of the Secret Service right there on the street, what they did right or wrong on Elm Street, and certainly what they, I know, you know, did wrong during that trip.
Well, Secret Service, let's talk about that for a minute. The Secret Service, there was some in the Secret Service that liked JFK, and there were some that didn't like him at all. Would they have taken a bullet for JFK? Well, when the shots first start ringing out, the only Secret Service agent, I mean, now officially, we have one Secret Service agent in the Zapruder film, but could there have been a second Secret Service agent that was cut out of the film? We have some eyewitnesses. We have some authors and researchers that state that there could be a second Secret Service agent already in the car before Clint Hill even reaches the car. And we have to remember Clint Hill was not JFK's Secret Service agent. He was Jackie's. So his job was to protect Jackie, not JFK.
You just said that there's some evidence or testimony that another agent ran up from the follow-up car before Clint Hill?
Yeah, we're getting into a gray area that some people may go, yeah, this guy is, you know, complete full of it. But, Larry Rivera, who I've done some exhaustive research with, and it has been exhausting, but I love the guy. He's going to be doing a presentation that we'll be discussing that next week. Casey Quinlan has brought this up before. We have to go back and look at the Zapruder film, and we have to pay close attention to Governor Connally and JFK, and then we also have to go back and look at the Cancellari photo once Hill is on the back of the limousine on the trunk, and look at where his foot's at and how could he possibly be in that position. We know it wasn't JFK and it wasn't Connally's foot. And of course I know the listening audience doesn't see pictures. This is just audio, but, the photographs are there that brings up the fact that there could have been another Secret Service agent in the car before Clint Hill even reached it.
That somehow jumped in and somehow got erased from the films. With me is David Knight, who's been studying the JFK assassination since 1989. And here now is important information from TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Look, anyone who's ever heard Vice President Kamala Harris speak or watched one of her patented laughing fits could see that something ain't right. It's like watching a cross between a second grade teacher and a wannabe comedian, and the American public sees it. Her approval rating is just 37% in the latest poll by 538. But over on MSNBC, Jen Psaki and election denier Stacey Abrams said it has nothing to do with how Kamala is doing.
Do you think she would be receiving these same critiques if she was a white man?
No.
No, not at all.
We will always question the person behind the person. But we cannot ignore that misogyny and racism remain very prevalent in our politics. And for those behaviors that don't rise to either misogyny or racism, there's also just the difference. Our expectations are set for the traditional white male vice president.
Oh, if only Kamala were a white male. Then her approval rating might be up there with Joe Biden's, right at 38%. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg. Listen to my show Monday through Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time right here on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads? Klaus Schwab, the chairman of the World Economic Forum, believes transhumanization is a fundamental part of the Great Reset within the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He states, the difference of this Fourth Industrial Revolution is it doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take genetic editing just as an example. It's you who are changed, and of course, this has a big impact on your identity.
Bruce DeTorres, Bruce DeTorres on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Speaking of identity, we are zeroing in on the JFK assassination with David Knight, one of the three propelling forces of Project JFK.com. And as wild as it is, and it would be wild, David, I think, to see compelling evidence of an agent beating Clint Hill to the car. Let's move on from that, if you don't mind, and talk about Alan Dulles and the CIA. Or let me flip that. Besides the photo that you're preparing, examining, making a great presentation in the conference next week, what about the JFK assassination is most important to you in conveying, besides what you already said, it was the crime of the century, what details about it to give, some real nice meat and potatoes on the bones here? And you could just riff and randomly, do some association in your mind. What are the things about it that are outrageous to you, and yet they are buried by the official story? What pisses you off that the mainstream, the government, and the media still has the audacity to hide from us?
I would say the number one thing is, I think the sheer gall that they think that we still will believe their BS 60 years later. I mean, especially after, the thing that really burns my butt is the fact that, we've had several years pass since the JFK Records Act, and we've had several delays in getting the records released. It's 60 years later. Jackie JFK Jr. Now, obviously, the entire family is not gone, but why are they still holding on to the documents? And why is it when we look at a spreadsheet, especially CIA documents, why are those still being withheld? And I know they stand behind, and I think they hide behind the idea of national security. This happened 60 years ago. Tell me where the national security is of why you cannot release the documents in full, mm-hmm. and just let us know. I mean, we're not the young generation back in the 60s. The younger generation today needs to know what took place and what happened to tell the whole story. Yeah. And if you want the story to truly go away, then give us the information and let us digest that to figure out in our minds what took place. Are we going to find a smoking gun in the documents? No. But are we going to be able to finally, you know, one day put it to rest? I hope so. I know,
Good.
I was going to say, I know that my kids are, you know, I have three children, and all three of them, thanks to me and, you know, Uncle Brian and Uncle Casey, they have been exposed, to what has taken place in the research community. And obviously what we do, all three of them have been to Dallas. And as a matter of fact, my two sons will be, you know, accompanying me to the conference next week.
Nice.
The fact of it is we've got to get the younger generation involved in this because, you know, eyewitnesses are passing away. First generation, yeah. second generation researchers are passing away. Who is going to pick up this baton and run with it, and who is going to join the fight? And the fight is to get the information from the government. You know, it's our information. It's our history.
Absolutely.
We can't whitewash it. We can't change our history. We can learn from it. And unfortunately, the way that the students are being taught today, they're being dumbed down. They're not learning what history really is and what the fact of it is. You have to know history because history doesn't repeat itself. History echoes. It echoes.
Fairly said. You know, when we were talking about the Secret Service, and Vince Palomara is widely regarded as the top civilian authority on the Secret Service, primarily due to his research into JFK's assassination. And it was he, or maybe it was Jim Mars, brought out the fact that in the 30 or 60 days before the assassination, a great number of agents on the president's detail were transferred to other stations, either in Washington or around the country, either by their request or by shuffling in the agency at an unusual, that's just one factoid that really intrigues one when one studies the assassination. Maybe it's Casey, maybe it's William Mattson Law, others who've said, you know, here's the fun thing about studying the JFK assassination as you begin it. You don't know if it's going to be a mild interest for you or it's going to really grab you and just keep pulling you. I like to say about it like I say about 9/11. Every place you look at the official story, it falls apart. Nothing of the official story stands without lots and lots of evidence and testimony calling it into question. And just as a reader of these things, I love to put my juror cap on, pretend I'm a member of a jury, and the government makes its case against Oswald with the official story in the Warren Report. It's more or less readable. It's essential if you want to get the foundation of, okay, what they say happened. And then there are literally countless books that document the witnesses and the evidence and the testimony that more than a reasonable doubt, casts more than a reasonable doubt to me on every single twist and turn element of the official story, to the extent that I say we need a new and a completely honest investigation. That's how absolutely fascinating the case is, and also urgent and important in terms of what it implies about who runs the government, what the government is doing to us, against us, lying to us. And that says a lot about the state of our freedom. Do you want to talk about, I'd love you to hear your thoughts, David, about the impact on the nation, what we've become because of JFK's assassination?
Well, Bruce, I couldn't agree more with what you just stated. what I go out and talk to, you know, the younger generation. I mean, I'm going to be 49 next week. So the people that are younger than me, I don't want to say I preach to them, but I stress it very hard that they have got to, you know, they've got to understand what took place in 1963, because if you look at everything that has taken place since 63, you look at Oklahoma City, you look at 9/11, the facts are there that, you know, history does echo, which I said earlier. But if you can't understand what took place that day and what the significance and the importance of, you know, assassinating the president of the United States, if you can't understand that, how are you going to understand what is going on in history since and what the history will be, you know, in the future?
Sure. I think there's a maxim in law whereby a judge will tell a jury before a case begins, as you're listening to a witness, let's say they're done with their testimony, or it's the third day of their testimony and everything's been going fine, and then we catch them in a lie. There's just no other way to understand that this witness has lied to you. I believe judges tell the juries, you are now free from believing anything he has said along the way. They may even tell the jury, you are instructed to disregard, or not, you know, something along the lines. That's what we have in a national government and major media and in all of our schools since 1963. You know, to be absolutely fair, sometimes they mention the findings of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which you mentioned, which concluded in 79. We think there was probably a conspiracy, and we recommend the Department of Justice investigate those things that we found that indicate that. And then in 1983, the Department of Justice issued a statement. We find no reason to reinvestigate King. I think it was about both the recommendations. And then in 88, they released a memo to some underling in some other federal department. No, we don't see any reason to reinvestigate the case, and that's where it closes. But the vast majority of times the case is referenced, the mainstream will say that the Warren Commission concluded, like you said, you know, Oswald did it alone. And that is just not good enough if we want to work to get our rights back and pretend that our representatives at the state, but certainly at the federal level, work for us. We can't even pretend that they work for us if they're telling lies about what you call, rightly, the crime of the century.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the reason why they sent that memo out and declined the idea of doing what the HSCA suggested they do, they got away with it. There was no more need to do investigations. As far as their idea was, they had their man, case was closed, and if this ever would have wound up, providing the fact that Oswald maybe, you know, if he wouldn't have gotten assassinated and taken out, even if this would have went to a court of law, Bruce, with what we had then and just the fact of how the investigation was done, Oswald probably would have got off, but he never made it that far.
Yeah, I've seen that kind of legal assessment by knowledgeable folks that say, nope, circumstantial, mitigating, coerced, whatever. But, yeah, in the early 80s, mid-80s, they could feel that they got away with it. But here's encouragement for the likes of you and the likes of me who are relentless in studying it and bringing it up. 1991, Oliver Stone's movie JFK horrified and outraged so many Americans. They gave Congress so much grief that they passed the JFK Records Act, as you well know, and said, we're going to have to release as much as we can. And they set up a big process to review the documents that they were holding. And I believe millions of records have come out. That's the right number, right?
Yeah, I would say that what Oliver Stone's film did in 1991, got Congress off their duff to, you know, start getting something done to get the information released. But then again, if you look back at the movie that came out before JFK, that got people more involved in the idea that this could be an assassination that was done by a conspiracy, was Executive Action. Those two films, and I understand that, you know, younger generation, they are more audiovisual. I give them a book. I don't know what they think they should do with it. Some of them don't even open up books anymore. They depend on their devices. But show them the two films, or at least one of the films. In particular, I make sure people, I always have extra copies of the movie JFK to pass out, whether it's on DVD or Blu-ray. But just get them involved to open their eyes to it. And then let them look and see, you know, what are they going to make their mind up for? And hopefully their eyes will be opened.
What can you tell me about your impression of his assassination being business as usual, just another regime change operation? If your research has gone wide enough to see it in context of other coup d'etats that the CIA mostly was involved in?
Well, I would say we look at the 1960s as a whole. And I know David Denton likes to, you know, talk about the political assassinations of the 1960s. We base our conferences off of that. It's not just JFK. And here's the thing. JFK was probably the most important, because of the office that he held. But if we look at the other assassinations that took place, in the 1960s, not just JFK, but RFK, MLK, Medgar Evers, Diem Brothers. Malcolm X, obviously. We go back and look at how Patton was killed. There's a strong resemblance between Patton's assassination, if that's what I think he was assassinated, and we look at how JFK was assassinated. There is so much of a echo, again, I'll throw that word out. There's so much of an echo of those two deaths, murders. It's hard not to look at it going, okay, this is business as usual. They've done it before. They're going to do it again.
Was Patton shot? I thought it was just a car accident.
Yeah, we look at the rubber bullet. Casey does a really great job of discussing this. He's got a great presentation on it as well. But if you look at the car being turned, slowing down, a rubber bullet that would have, you know, caused, that could have caused the death of Patton, it wasn't just a car accident. It was assassination. And okay. It echoes JFK almost to a T.
I've seen allusions to that in my reading. I haven't really put my attention to it. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be surprised, because like you described those other assassinations, and what we have in our hands is, the continuation of the national security state that we became after World War II, you know, and it's absolutely fascinating because it leads to the Nazis we brought over with Operation Paperclip, and it leads to the, you know, all the psychological warfare, lies, and other stories told to the American people to distract us from how Kennedy's economic policies, his foreign policy, what he was doing in Vietnam, everything changed after he was taken out. And we've had 6 decades now of that kind of nonsense where we are just the bullying brutes. We've got less than a minute left. David Knight, ProjectJFK.com, JFKHistorical.com for the conference coming up. What are your final thoughts, mi amigo?
Well, I want to say thank you again, Bruce, for having me today. And please, everybody, check out ProjectJFK.com.
Thank you, David. We got to go. This is TNT Radio.